Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Greetings. This is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, May 15th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Later on, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the ongoing resistance by the Palestinian people to the occupation and repression of the United States-funded government of Israel in the occupied lands. Seychelles is attempting to vaccinate its population against the COVID-19 pandemic in the Southern African Development Community State. Madagascar is battling drought and a threatened famine in the south of the SADC member country. Kenya is facing the impact of climate change as the threat of crop destruction remains a major threat inside this East African territory. In the second hour, we listen to a briefing from the World Health Organization Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, talking on international vaccination efforts aimed at curbing the coronavirus pandemic. Finally, we examine in detail the current struggle in Palestine and other current events taking place in Africa and throughout the international community. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take a musical interlude. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
بخاف من الحب وسرت الحب وظلم الحب الكل سرت الحب وظلم الحب الحب الكل الصعب. سهره الحب وظلم الحب الكل اصحاب واعرف حكايات مليانه اهات واعرف حكايات مليانه اهات ودموع الحب وظلم الحب الكل أصحابه طول عمري باخاني الحب وزرت الحب وظلم الحب الكل حكايات مليانة أهار أعرف حكايات مليانة أهار ودموع أهل الحب صحيح مساكين صحيح I'm يا مشوق حاول يحيلني.
اللي ظلمته الحب وقلت وعدت عليه قلت عليه مش عارف ايه اللي ظلمته الحب وقلت وعدت عليه قلت عليه مش عارف ايه اللي ظلمته الحب وقلت عدت عليه قلت عليه مش عارف ايه العيب فيكم يا حبايب العيب فيكم يا حبايبكم اما الحب اما الحب يا روح يا روح يا روح يا Yeah. على حلاوتنا يا سلام يا سلام يا سلام الدنيا وحلاوتها بعين العشاق يا سلام يا سلام على حلاوتنا يا سلام يا سلام وانا خدني الحب لقيتني بحس Thank you. حضراتك همساتك شيء مش معقول شيء خلى الدنيا زهور على طول وشموع على طول زهور على طول وشموع على طول زهور على طول وشموع على طول يا اللي مليت من حب حياتي اهدي حياتي اليك يا اللي مليت من حب حياتي اهدي حياتي
Bye.
Welcome back. And we listened to the revolutionary music of Egypt during the time of President Abdel Nasser. And that was Umm Kulthum. And, of course, live in concert in Cairo, Egypt, during the 1960s. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast for today, May 15th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. And our lead story, of course, deals with the current situation in Palestine. According to Press TV, rock sirens and rocket sirens blare throughout Tel Aviv and central occupied territories as Hamas says it fired dozens of rockets at Israel in response to the killing of a Palestinian family of 10, including 8 children. Israeli media reported that a rocket had exploded in central Ramat Gan, with footage from Ramat Gan showing a car burning and damage to nearby buildings. Sirens were heard in Tel Aviv, Rishon, Lizion, Holon, Bat Yam, Ashdod, Yavni, Rohavat, Givat Tayem, Petah Tikva, Kirat Ono, and more. A man aged around 50 was killed in the rocket strike in Ramat Gan, and several people were injured. Police later said two rockets had hit the city. According to reports, one of the rockets fired from Gaza exploded in the town of Taibe, northeast of Tel Aviv, and another hit near the Israeli settlement of Karne Shamron. The residents of Taibe gathered to celebrate Palestinian resistance at the scene of the rocket strike. They denounced the Israeli regime's violence against Palestinians at Jerusalem Al-Quds Al-Aqsa Mosque and shouted, "With spirit, with blood, will redeem Al-Aqsa." Hamas's military wing, Izzedine Al-Qassam Brigades, said it launched dozens of rockets at the occupying regime in response to a pre-dawn strike by Israeli warplanes against the El-Shati refugee camp, which killed 8 children and 2 women from the Abu Hatab family and injured 15 others. Israeli police and rescue personnel at the scene of a rocket strike in Ramat Gan that left one person dead on May 15th, 2021. Today is Al-Nakba, the 73rd anniversary of the Declaration of the State of Israel. And of course, the Palestinians refer to this day as the catastrophe. The Israeli military have destroyed the Al-Jalah Tower in Gaza after sending a roof-knocking missile as a final warning to leave. Israel had reportedly warned occupants of the building, which houses certain media outlets such as Al Jazeera, the Associated Press, along with Arab and local press, to evacuate. The regime had said the building would be bombed within an hour. Following the warning, Al Jazeera aired a phone call between the building's owner and an Israeli intelligence officer asking to be given more time to evacuate equipment from the offices, but the Israeli officer declined the request. Disregarding the outrage caused by its earlier warning, Israel bombed the tower. Meanwhile, Abu Abdulhadi, a spokesman for the Izzedine Al-Qassam Brigade, said they fired a rocket-propelled grenade at Tel Aviv in response to the threat. He also said the Palestinian resistance is ready for 6 consecutive months of Tel Aviv's bombardment, hitting at the 6 consecutive days since the beginning of Israel's onslaught against Gaza. Hamas, the Political Bureau Chief Ismail Haniyeh, said earlier that the Israeli regime massacre of Palestinians in an Al-Shati refugee camp shows the regime's desperation and defeat in the face of Palestinian resistance. The massacre demonstrates the extent of impasse that the occupiers are experiencing against the grandeur of resistance. We hold the cruel occupying regime fully responsible for targeting civilians, and we stress that resistance will continue to defend the proud people of Palestine and that it will emerge victorious. Palestinians condemn Israel and they celebrate resistance. Meanwhile, Palestinians on Saturday today took to the streets of the occupied West Bank to protest against the Israeli regime's occupation and the ongoing bombardment of Gaza. The rallies mark Nakba Day, or the day of the occupation of Palestine, which began 73 years ago. 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their land with the aim of creating the illegitimate state of Israel, told from the Israeli regime's relentless aerial bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip, which continued for a sixth consecutive day, has so far killed at least 139 Palestinians, including 39 children and 22 women, while leaving 950 others wounded. In the United States, Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota has condemned the United States President Joe Biden for siding with Israel's oppressive occupation of Palestine and carrying out recent atrocities against the Palestinians. The Minnesota representative, who is a Muslim of Somalian descent, made the remarks in a Twitter post after Biden called Israeli's President Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday, where he said Israel had a right to defend itself. According to the White House, Biden conveyed his unwavering support for Israel's security and for Israel's legitimate right to defend itself and its people while protecting civilians. He also conveyed the United States' encouragement of a pathway towards restoring substantial calm. He shared his conviction that Jerusalem, Al-Quds, a city of such importance to people of faith from around the world, must be a place of peace. He updated the Prime Minister of the United States' diplomatic engagement with regional countries, including Egypt, Jordan, and Qatar, as well as with the Palestinian officials. That's according to a White House statement. Commenting on this, Ilhan Omar said, "No mention of Sheikh Jarrah, no mention of Al-Aqsa raids, no mention of the 13 innocent children killed in airstrikes, no mention of the ongoing occupation of millions in an open-air prison. You aren't prioritizing human rights. You're siding with an oppressive occupation." Her comments came as Israel continued its airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip. This occurred on Tuesday and Wednesday, drawing a barrage of rockets from resistance groups in Gaza. The Palestinian Health Ministry said the death toll from the Israeli raids has risen to 86, including 17 children and 7 women. According to Palestinian officials, some 95% of the victims are civilians. The Israeli airstrikes also wounded 487 people in over 3 days of attacks on the besieged enclave. Israel said some 1,600 rockets have been fired towards the occupied territories by resistance groups in Gaza since Monday evening. The Qassam Brigade say there are no, quote, red lines, unquote, for the resistance group in protecting Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Palestinian territories. The Israeli blockaded Gaza Strip and the occupied Palestinian territories have been simmering with rage in the past weeks over Israel's scheme to expel dozens of Palestinians from their homes in the volatile Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the Old City in occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, as part of a long-running scheme to Judaize Palestinian lands. The anger against the Tel Aviv regime further intensifies earlier this month with Israeli attacks on Palestinian worshippers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound during the fasting days of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The Israeli military has been under fire globally over its crimes against Palestinians, especially those residing in Gaza, which has already been under a crippling Israeli siege. Also, the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas said it has targeted the Israeli regime's Iron Dome stations in an Israeli air base which is used by Israeli warplanes to bombard civilians' targets in the besieged Gaza Strip. "We fired a volley of Sejel missiles at the Hasharim air base from which the occupation warplanes flew to bomb civilians in Gaza," the Izzedine Al-Qassam Brigade's Hamas's military wing said in a statement on Thursday night, according to the Palestinian media. The group said it also attacked a chemical factory in Nahal Oz Kibbutz in the Negev Desert with the Shahab suicide drones. The announcement followed an earlier statement by Hamas that it had launched a number of suicide drones carrying explosive payloads into southern Israel from the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military claimed downing 2 such drones. A rocket from Gaza earlier yesterday hit a building in the city of Ashkelon, with no immediate report of casualties. Al Jamaa News Agency reported rockets, sirens were heard in Ashdod, Ziderat, and Jahar Hanagav region after a night of intense fighting. Hamas said it has launched at least 250 rockets into Israeli-occupied territories in the last few hours in response to the Israeli regime's relentless aerial bombardment of Gaza that has so far killed, at least according to this source, 119 Palestinians, including 31 children and 19 women, and injured 800 others. On Thursday evening, Hamas said it targeted two of Israel's so-called Iron Dome stations, located east of Khan Yunis and east of Gaza, with a number of rocket-propelled grenades. Hebrew media reported that the Iron Dome's batteries were hit by several rocket-propelled grenades, Royal News reported. Abu Abuadi, a spokesman for the Izzedin al-Qassam Brigade, had previously said that there are no red lines when it comes to responding to the Zionist enemy. He also said that the resistance group had begun using a new missile that can reach anywhere in Israel. Rockets were launched towards the Ramon Airport with the Ayash missile with a range of 250 kilometers. That's 155 miles, Abu Abiyad said on Thursday. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. This is the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. You can read these articles in their entirety, in their details, at the Pan-African Newswire website. Now, we have been covering extensively the situation in Palestine. In the Southern African Development Community region, the president of Seychelles has refuted doubts over the effectiveness of China's COVID-19 vaccine produced by Sinopharm amid the epidemic surge in the country. President Wavell Ramkalawan said the vaccine is effectively helping to protect people from getting sick. Chinese experts said that questioning by foreign media over the effectiveness of Sinopharm's vaccine is arbitrary, and the surge of COVID-19 cases in Seychelles is fueled by multiple factors, such as mutant strains and the level of protective antibodies in the population. Seychelles, an island nation located in the Indian Ocean with a population under 100,000 people, is so far the most vaccinated country in the world, with 69% of its population having received at least one shot. 51% of the population is fully vaccinated, according to research published by Our World in Data. The Sinopharm vaccine was administered to people aged 18 to 60, while the Covishield and AstraZeneca vaccine produced in India were given to people above 60 years old, said President Ramkalawan in an interview with Seychelles News Agency just this last past Monday. Also in the SADC region, more than 1 million people in southern Madagascar are facing acute food insecurity as the region grapples with its worst drought in four decades, the United Nations said on Tuesday. A helicopter of the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, Food and Agricultural Organization, flies and flew through millions of locusts as they spread pesticides to fight against a swarm of locusts that periodically threaten to reach various rural areas in Madagascar. Five straight years of low rainfall have wiped out harvests and hampered access to food, compounding the effect of erosion caused by deforestation and devastating sandstorms. Around 1.14 million people in the south of Madagascar are facing high levels of acute food insecurity, the World Food Program and Food and Agricultural Organization said in a statement. Almost 14,000 of these people have been classed in Category 5, the highest level of the UN food scarcity ranks, a first for Madagascar since the scale was introduced in 2016. With each day that passes, more lives are at stake as hunger tightens its grip, the statement said. UN agencies are seeking attention to a humanitarian crisis that says risk being visible. The Indian Ocean island country borders have been shut since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, making it difficult for aid agencies to provide relief. Acute malnutrition rates are rising in the worst affected Abu Sari at Simo district, where up to three quarters of the population have been impacted, by the disasters. And finally, in the East African state of Kenya, climate change is set to devastate the country's tea production as the world's largest exporter faces rising temperatures, erratic rainfall, and insect infestation, according to an analysis released just this last past Monday. Tea is the world's most consumed drink after water, and disruption in supply from the East African nation is predicted to have a global impact. A report from the charity Christian Aid outlined the various threats Kenya faces to its key black tea crop, as well as the dangers that other countries are likely to encounter as the planet continues to warm. Citing a peer-reviewed study, the report said the quadruple threat of rising temperatures, erratic rainfall, droughts, and the new insect infestations are forecast to destroy 26.2% of the country's optimal tea-growing areas by 2050, less than three decades away. And climate change is expected to reduce the areas with medium quality growing conditions by nearly 40% in the same time frame. For generations, we have carefully cultivated our tea farms, and we are proud that the tea that we grow here is the best in the world, said Richard Koske, a tea farmer from Kenya's Western Highlands. But climate change poses a real threat to us. We cannot predict seasons anymore. Temperatures are rising, and rainfall is more erratic. Karimi Kinote, head of the Christian Aid Africa Division, said tea was just another example of how people living in countries least responsible for climate crisis are bearing the heaviest burden. Africans make up 17% of the world's population, but we generate just 4% of the greenhouse gas emissions that have caused the climate crisis. And yet, it is we who are suffering the brunt of the impact of climate change. The report warned that the livelihoods of more than 3 million people in Kenya's tea industry would come under threat in the next two decades. Mohamed Adal, director of the PowerShift Africa Climate and Energy Think Tank, said the COP26 negotiations presented a vital opportunity for richer nations to provide proper support. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding, we want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in numerous newspapers, in various magazines and journals and research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And, of course, if you want to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that is at blogtalkradio.com / Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com / Pan-African Journal. Now, the programs can be shared by other potential listeners by merely copying and pasting the links into emails and sending them out to other potential listeners. They can also be shared through social media sites such as Facebook and Twitter. This is Abayomi Azikiwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And, of course, we are here commemorating the 73rd anniversary of al-Nakba. And, of course, this represents the 73rd anniversary of the declaration of the State of Israel. And, of course, we are in solidarity here at the Pan-African Journal with the Palestinian people and their struggle for national liberation and for sovereignty over their lands. And we'll take a musical interlude, and we'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. My name is Abayomi Azikiwe. I am your host of the Pan-African Journal, and we are here every single week bringing you some of the most updated and advanced information on the situation involving African people throughout the planet. And, of course, as we mentioned earlier, these programs are available. All you have to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and today's program is available, as well as over 1,000 other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal. We'll be right back with more of our program for this week.
If you want my love, if you really do, don't be afraid, hey, baby. Stop asking, I know I'm gonna give it to you. Oh, and I do declare,
I do.
I wanna see you with it. Say, chop, chop, little boy.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast, and that was Detroit's own Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, with the tune entitled Baby, I Love You from 1967. And we do love you here at the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to another edition of our program for May 15th, 2021. Right now we're going to go to a briefing from the World Health Organization Director General's Office, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. This briefing was done on yesterday. It discusses many aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic, the rollout of vaccination programs globally, among other international
hello and good day to wherever you're listening to us today. It is Friday, 14 May 2021. Apologies for the late start today. Therefore, let's get started. My name is Christian Lindmann, and I'm welcoming you to today's Global COVID-19 Press Conference. Simultaneous translation is provided in the 6 official UN languages, Arabic, Chinese, French, English, Spanish, and Russian, plus Portuguese and Hindi. Now let me introduce the participants in the room. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, WHO Director General. Dr. Mike Ryan, Executive Director of WHO's Health Emergencies Program. Dr. Maria van Kerkhove, Technical Lead on COVID-19. Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, Chief Scientist. Dr. Maria Angela Simao, Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines and Health Products. Dr. Bruce Aylward, Special Advisor to the Director General and the Lead on ACT Accelerator. With this, let me hand over to the Director General for the opening remarks. Dr. Tedros.
Thank you, Christian. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Earlier this week, I was vaccinated against COVID-19. It was a bittersweet moment. On the one hand, vaccination is a triumph of science and global solidarity. Alongside public health measures, vaccination is key to controlling this pandemic, and I'm very grateful to the health workers at the Geneva University Hospital, HUG, for helping me play my part. However, my thoughts were very much with the health workers around the world who have been fighting this pandemic for more than a year. The fact that so many are still not protected is a sad reflection on the gross distortion in access to vaccines across the globe. Last September, in The Economist, we warned about the threat of vaccine nationalism, and some said we were being alarmist. In January, I spoke about the potential unfolding of a moral catastrophe. Unfortunately, we're now witnessing this play out. In a handful of rich countries, which bought up the majority of the vaccine supply, lower risk groups are now being vaccinated. I understand why some countries want to vaccinate their children and adolescents, but right now I urge them to reconsider and to instead donate vaccines to COVAX. Because in low and lower middle income countries, vaccine supply has not been enough to even immunize health and care workers, and hospitals are being inundated with people that need life-saving care urgently. At present, only 0.3% of vaccine supply is going to low-income countries. Trickle-down vaccination is not an effective strategy for fighting a deadly respiratory virus. India remains hugely concerning, with several states continuing to see a worrying number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. WHO is responding and has shipped thousands of oxygen concentrators, tents for mobile field hospitals, masks, and other medical supplies. And we thank all the stakeholders who are supporting India. But it's not only India that has emergency needs. Nepal, Sri Lanka, Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, and Egypt are just some of the countries that are dealing with spikes in cases and hospitalizations. Some countries in the Americas still have high numbers of cases, and as a region, the Americas accounted for 40% of all COVID-19 deaths last week. There are also some spikes in some countries in Africa. These countries are in heightened response mode, and WHO will continue to provide support in all ways possible. COVID-19 has already cost more than 3.3 million lives, and we're on track for the second year of this pandemic to be far more deadly than the first. Saving lives and livelihoods with a combination of public health measures and vaccination not one or the other, is the only way out of the pandemic. Vaccine supply remains a key challenge, but this week I have been pleased to see leaders and manufacturers working to address some of these issues. First, there have been a number of new country announcements about sharing vaccines with COVAX, which is the fastest way to ensure equitable rollout of vaccines. Second, new deals involving tech transfer and sharing of know-how between international manufacturers to scale up vaccine production has been announced. And third, leaders, including the Prime Minister of Spain, Pedro Sanchez, have called for all trade barriers to be lifted as soon as possible. Muchas gracias. As we welcome this momentum, WHO has again convened researchers and scientists from around the world to update the research and innovation roadmap to take stock of what we have learned and identify the most pressing knowledge gaps. From the outset of this pandemic, WHO's R&D blueprint for epidemics played a facilitating and coordinating role, convening expert networks to drive progress across a range of thematic areas and connecting key funders to focus on identified research priorities. In the past 18 months, major advances have been made in the understanding of modes of transmission, epidemiological trends, clinical management, development of point-of-care diagnostics, treatments, and a large number of vaccines. Social and behavioral scientists and ethics experts have also worked to ensure that research was up to the highest ethical standards. The research forum is being webcast live over 2 days, and I challenged them to deliver complete solutions that take the development, evaluation, and deployment of tools from their beginning to their end, prioritizing both equity and efficiency. I urged them to expand collaboration between expert groups and partners and utilize global research capacity that has not yet been sufficiently leveraged, particularly in lower income countries. And finally, I urged them to further promote large platform trials across the world. This is the fastest way to prove the efficacy of new diagnostics, treatments, and vaccines. It's amazing how far the world has come in less than 18 months. But I have high hopes that breakthrough innovation will continue at record pace. Yesterday, I announced the winners of the second WHO Health for All Film Festival, and I have been thinking since about the importance of telling stories to increase awareness, build solidarity, and foster positive change. I was struck by how each film winner creatively reflected new situations and different realities, highlighting challenges, but also a way through. Watching the news, sometimes it might seem that the world's problems are intractable, but I want you to know that WHO will keep fighting to defend the health rights of all people everywhere in the world. The one thing they had in common was that to beat the challenges of our time, we must bridge our divides and craft new stories together. This week, Muslim brothers and sisters have been celebrating Eid al-Fitr, and I want to end by wishing Eid Mubarak to everyone celebrating. Stay safe, and again, Eid Mubarak. Christian, back to you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tedros. This opens the floor to questions from the media. And let me start with Belisa Gohinho from the W Magazine Portugal. Belisa, please unmute yourself. Elisa, please unmute yourself if you can hear us. Right, we'll come back to you, Elisa, if we don't, if we can reconnect, apparently. That opens the floor to Kai Kupferschmidt from Science. Kai, please unmute yourself.
Thanks, Christian. Thank you. I wanted to ask all of you about a reaction to the IPPPR report. I mean, specifically, there's a number of recommendations in there, and I'm curious whether you feel that they are the right recommendations. I mean, there's the recommendation to restrict the future DGs to one term of 7 years. There's other recommendations to make the WHO more powerful, like having standing visas for experts to allow them to go into countries to investigate outbreaks. Just in general terms, do you feel that, that the report basically, you know, lays out a roadmap also for WHO reform for the next few years?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Kai. On the reports, as you rightly said, it's not only IPPR, but we will have a report from IHR Review Committee. We will have a report from IOSE, the Independent Oversight Advisory Committee. So there are sets of recommendations from them as well. And there are other platforms also who are sending us recommendations. So one thing we need to do is we will pull all these recommendations together and discuss with member states. As you know, we will have an assembly soon, at the end of this month. And then, you know, all recommendations will be assessed. So very difficult now to say, to comment on one or the other recommendations. And in addition to the three, we're encouraging other stakeholders and, you know, institutions also to give us ideas and recommendations. So that's going to be an incredible process. And, you know, this pandemic is really unprecedented, and we have to be open-minded and learn and use the recommendations that are coming to the best we can, and to prepare the world in, you know, for the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tedros. Next question goes to Agnes Pedrero from AFP. Agnes, please unmute yourself.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. It's a question on the US. US has just decided to waive the mask requirements when people are fully vaccinated. So I wanted to know what WHO think about that move. Do you consider it as a safe move or dangerous? And is it a recommendation that WHO plans to do? Do you plan to waive the mask requirements when people are fully vaccinated? And if yes, in which conditions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we'll hand to Dr. Van Kerkhove, please.
Thanks very much. So as you know, WHO recommends masks, the use of masks as part of a comprehensive strategy towards controlling COVID, part of many different measures that are used to prevent the spread. In setting up policies to use masks as part of that strategy, it's very contextual. It's about how much virus is circulating around in the country. It's about the amount of vaccines and vaccinations that are rolling out. It's about the variants of interest, the variants of concerns that are circulating. We have to keep all of this in mind when thinking about how to adjust the policies associated with the use of masks. So it is contextual. So all of these considerations need to be taken into account. Controlling COVID, controlling the circulation of SARS-CoV-2 virus is key. No matter what else is happening around, if there are variants or not, if vaccination is around, how much virus is circulating is really important. The use of vaccines, which vaccines, the age of the person, the underlying conditions, whether they've had one dose or two dose or fully vaccinated or not, all of this needs to be taken into account. So it isn't a simple yes or no answer. It's about setting that risk-based approach and using masks appropriately in the setting. I'll remind you that in some countries, they've been able to control COVID and they've been able to adjust their public health and social measures, including the use of masks, without the use of vaccines. So I always think of Australia and New Zealand, and I picture people in the stadiums, you know, going to sporting events. And so any adjustment that is made, whether it's masks or physical distancing, all of these considerations need to be put in place. You know, we're not out of this yet. There are uncertainties ahead because of these virus variants. We just have to stay the course, do everything that we can, first and foremost, to prevent infections, reduce the spread, and save lives.
And just supplementing what Maria said, because you asked would WHO be issuing specific advice. I think in this case, we need to reemphasize that clearly getting vaccinated protects you from serious illness and death. And in the case of many of the vaccines, where the data is available, significant impact on your likelihood to infect others or be infected by others. But as Maria said, this is all in the context of the local transmission conditions. So in Australia and New Zealand, even when there weren't any vaccines, people could take their masks off because there wasn't any virus. Even in situations where you have high vaccine coverage, if you've got a lot of transmission, then you wouldn't take your mask off. So you cannot make one decision without the other. In the instance of a country that wishes to reduce or take away a mask mandate or take away other measures of public health and social measures, that should only be done in the context of considering both the intensity and of transmission in your area and the level of vaccination coverage. Now, obviously, if you have high vaccination coverage, you should have low community transmission. But we're in a strange period of being transitioning as vaccination coverage increases and as transmission levels go down. And we're at a point where many countries are facing a situation where the transmission hasn't completely ended and their people aren't completely vaccinated. And that's where we are on the curves. One is meeting the other. And as long as we can sustain the public health measures, as long as we can keep the distance and as long as we can reduce exposure while we get vaccination levels to the highest level, then countries will be in a much stronger position when they do get to high vaccine coverage levels to start saying to people, you don't have to wear a mask anymore. So Maria is absolutely correct in that regard. So each country will need to look at those two issues, our vaccine coverage and the local incidence rate in any given setting as to whether the mandates for public health and social measures can change. I don't know, Bruce, if you have a comment. But
well, thanks for the invitation, Mike. I would reinforce what Maria and Mike have just said. And we've been in previous press conferences, we've been asked about places that are having escalating outbreaks in the face of rising vaccination coverage because they've not reached all of the population. There are still other drivers, and that's the reality. Right now, you want to be doing everything possible to get you want to get your transmission down to as low levels as possible and take advantage of every countermeasure, every societal behavioral measure one can to do that. And countries will make decisions for various important context-specific reasons, exactly as Mike said. And at a global level, the World Health Organization, you know, the wonderful thing about being an organization of 194 member states is the diversity of what they will do and that learning and the ability to learn. There's no complete right or wrong in this crisis. We're learning as we go. We all are. And what's happening in different countries right now as they get higher vaccination rates will help inform that global policy as we go forward.
Okay. Thank you very much, all. Next question goes to Simon Atibara from Today News Africa. Simon, please unmute yourself.
Thank you for taking my question. This is Simon Atiba with Today News Africa in Washington, D.C. I would like the WHO to react to recent report that a small number of people, very small number of people who had been fully vaccinated have tested positive for the coronavirus. I was wondering what that means and how long do various vaccines protect against the virus. And if you may allow me on President Biden, his administration would like to share the AstraZeneca vaccine is not used now by July. I was wondering if the WHOMD has called the White House to ask for those vaccines now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Simon, and we'll hand to Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, Chief Scientist.
Yes, thank you for that question. I think we need to understand what is expected of vaccines and how they work. We are very fortunate that the majority of vaccines that have been developed and tested are highly effective against preventing disease, and particularly against preventing the severe forms of the disease, which result in people having to be hospitalized and needing critical care and ventilation. So again, majority of vaccines approved till now, or almost all of them that are being used, are accompanied by reductions in the need for hospitalization and definitely in the deaths that occur in the groups that are being immunized. However, these vaccines are all not 100% effective against preventing infection. The good news is that they do prevent infection in the range of 70 to 80%, again, from the data that's coming out now from real-world studies in countries that are scaling vaccination. We are learning more and more about how these vaccines behave at the population level rather than how they behave at the in clinical trials. So we know that they do protect against infection, but not completely. So you can still get infected. You can have asymptomatic or a mild illness or even moderate symptoms even after being vaccinated. So that's not a complete surprise. And again, that's why the WHO has said that vaccination alone is not a guarantee against infection or against being able to transmit that infection to others. It may be a rare occurrence, but it could still occur, and that's why we need the other protective measures like the mask wearing and the distancing and so on, till countries get to the level at which a large number of people are protected and at where virus circulation and the transmission goes to very low levels, as Dr. Ryan was explaining. So very few countries are at the point now where they can drop, you know, these measures by individuals and by governments, because the virus is at such low levels. In most countries, we still need to continue to do that. What is also important is, on the research side, is to continue to document the performance of vaccines. And so the WHO has put out guidance on designs for research studies, both for randomized trials when you're testing a vaccine for the first time or comparing different vaccines, but also for vaccine effectiveness studies. Once they're being rolled out, we need to study both the effectiveness and the safety of these vaccines, and different populations, you know, countries have used different regimes. You know, some have used standard duration of the gap between the first and second dose. Other countries have used longer gaps. Some have used a mix and match approach for the second dose. So all of this, if it's documented properly, will give us a lot of information. And finally, I think we also need to continue to do the studies with the efficacy of the vaccines against the different variants. As we're seeing these different variants emerge and increase in numbers, we need to accompany the effectiveness studies with sequencing of the breakthrough infections so that we can also do an analysis and understand about vaccine efficacy against particular variants. Again, at this point in time, most of the vaccines in use are effective against severe disease, whatever the variant that's circulating in the country. But this is an evolving area, and we need to continue to collect high-quality information. Thank you.
Thank you. And for part two, we'll go to Dr. Bruce Aylward.
Thank you very much, Christian. And to the point that Sonia just made, there was a, you know, sometimes we talk at the population level about the impact of vaccines and the possibility of breakthrough transmission, et cetera. There was a very nice piece actually yesterday by a journalist actually who'd been fully vaccinated, did actually get the disease, and then just contrasted his situation with another person at a very similar age situation to that he did. It was a science journalist who wrote a very nice piece and just contrasted the clinical course that they made and really brought to life that while he may still get infected, he thinks it was the vaccine that probably saved his life. And a journalist with a lot of experience in science reporting, I thought it was an interesting piece to see it at that human level. In terms of that second issue about donations of vaccines and whether we're in touch with countries that have the potential to donate to COVAX in particular. Yes, absolutely. I think there was a specific question, Simon, you had, are we in touch with the United States? And absolutely, and we have been for some time, and the U.S. has been absolutely fantastic in reaching out to us as well. It's a two-way conversation about how to optimize the use of potential doses. And this is not an issue unique to that country. We're in conversations with many, many countries that have potentially can provide some of their doses. And we have to be careful because we often talk about excess or surplus doses. And, you know, these countries all explain, like we talked about last week with Sweden, that no one has surplus doses. Everyone's trying to use all of their doses to the greatest possible impact, but they recognize that sharing those doses may help ensure greater impact overall. And in that regard, what countries are looking at is, you know, how could they have the greatest reach, get to the most countries? And that is through COVAX. We've gotten to 122 countries, some of the most disadvantaged. How can they get out there as fast as possible? And clearly, that's through COVAX. After the French signed the agreement, within 24 hours, the doses were in the target country we were working out with Mauritania. How can they have the highest possible impact and most equitable distribution? Again, through COVAX. We have that global view through the COVAX facility to ensure that countries that aren't receiving enough doses to reach their healthcare workers, reach their older populations, can reach them. So that's the conversation, Simon. It's with a very broad range of countries. It's an ongoing discussion. And, you know, with the United States in particular, they've highlighted that they want to be ready when the doses are ready, because there is still, you know, there's this idea that there's a huge stockpile sitting somewhere, but there's a lot of work to releasing batches, ensuring that they've been through all the steps necessary. So we're working in parallel to ensure when doses can flow, they go as fast as possible to have as high an impact as possible in as many places as possible.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Aylward. Next question goes to Nikolai Voronin from the BBC World Service. Nikolai, please unmute yourself.
Hello, thank you for taking my question. I'm going to ask about post-COVID syndrome, which is mounting pressure on healthcare system all around the world, and people keep suffering tremendously from consequences months after official recovery. In the USA, they suggest classifying post-COVID syndrome as a disability. What's WHO position on that? And as a follow-up, what do you know for sure, scientists know for sure, about what causes long COVID, post-COVID syndrome, and what are the prospective possible outcomes? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nikolai. Over to Dr. von Kerkhove.
Yeah, thank you. I'll start. This is a really good question, and it's a huge area of work right now. Your question was, what do we know for certain? And I can say we don't know anything for certain, but there is a lot of research that's underway. For individuals who have been infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, as you know, there are some people who have an acute infection. They recover from that infection, recover from that illness, that disease that they've had, and there are individuals who are suffering from some long-term effects. We're working with our clinical management group, our rehab group, brain health, mental health, many, many, many different disciplines are working together to understand this post-COVID syndrome, you know, even to just define it. To put boundaries around what it is and what it isn't requires a lot of research. Dr. Tedros and I and others have met with patient groups for almost a year now, maybe not quite a year, and they have asked for recognition that this is a real thing, and it is a real thing. We're trying to better define the case definition, what it is. There have been several seminars that we've had, workshops that we have had with researchers around the world from many different disciplines, because this affects many different organs, to define post-COVID syndrome, making sure that we have good research, that is cohort studies that are following individuals who may not have had a diagnosis early on in the pandemic because testing wasn't as widespread as it needed to be in the beginning, for example. But we want to make sure that these cohorts of individuals cover areas around the world, that they don't just cover patients from high-income countries. So we're working to set up these studies, these multi-center studies, looking at the long-term effects and what it actually means. And then lastly, to make sure that we could have good rehabilitation. What does rehabilitation need, and how do we tailor that to make sure that people receive the care that they need, whether they had a diagnosis or not? So there's a lot of work that is underway. We do know that this is real. We do know that this affects many different organs. But what we're trying to do is to have good systematic data collection to be able to inform the treatment protocols, the rehab protocols, so that anyone can get the care that they need around the world. But really, this is a dangerous virus. There's a lot that we need to learn from this. This teaches us that even though some people may have what is classified as a mild disease, there may be a short-term disease, and then there may be some long-term effects. So we really need to do what we can to study this to make the best treatment policies, rehab policies, as we can.
Thank you very much, Dr. von Kerkhoff. Next question goes to Priti Patnaik from Geneva HealthSize. Priti, please unmute yourself.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my question. This is about remdesivir. We see that a lot of people in India are using up precious resources they have to buy up a drug that WHO has said is not effective for treatment of COVID-19 in hospitalized patients. And it's a bit puzzling because a number of countries are also donating doses of remdesivir. And we also understand that the company is expanding production. Could you comment on this? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Priti. Just looking around, who may want to start? Dr. Swaminathan, please.
Yeah, thank you, Priti. I can start, and others might want to come in. You know, the area of therapeutics and treatments for COVID-19 obviously is of great interest to people, and unfortunately has not been, you know, with as much dramatic progress as we've seen in the vaccines or even in the diagnostics, for example. So while a large number of clinical trials, you know, have been done and are ongoing, we're tracking something like 9,000 clinical trials in our registry. There have been very few large trials which have given concrete results on some drugs. And I think the first one, and still I think the most important one, is the role of steroids, corticosteroids and dexamethasone, in the treatment, especially of severe and critical cases of COVID-19, those who require oxygen and those who require ventilation benefit. There's a mortality benefit. The Solidarity trial is probably the largest trial in the world to have tested remdesivir. All the other trials, there are four or five others, much, much smaller. And also the Solidarity trial was able to look at mortality because it's a large trial, and mortality is really the end point that most clinicians and patients would want to see an impact on. And as far as remdesivir and the impact on mortality was concerned, there was no difference in this large trial and also in the meta-analyses compared to the control group. So this is why the WHO guideline development group, which is a completely independent group of experts, nothing to do with the research group, and which looks at evidence that's synthesized across all of the different studies done across the world. And as you know, we now perform something called a living meta-analysis and a network meta-analysis, which looks at the impact of different drugs when they're used in combination or alone, found that remdesivir did not have a benefit in terms of mortality or in terms of deterioration. What it did do in the trial conducted by the NIH was it reduced hospitalization duration. So one has to look at the benefits versus the costs of a drug, and that's again depends on the country context. Some countries reducing hospitalization by 4 days would be an advantage. In other countries, that is not the major driver, and it should be based more on the impact on patient outcomes, which is, again, mortality or deterioration. So our guideline at the moment recommends against the use of remdesivir. We will look at emerging evidence and update our guidelines as it becomes available, but I think it's important for physicians and doctors to be aware of the latest evidence and to use it in whichever drug it is, to use it judiciously and wisely and at the right time, and also to look at the benefit versus the cost. So obviously every country makes their own treatment guidelines based on the evidence that's available and based on their local context. And so we would leave it to the country to adopt WHO's guidelines and adapt them as they see fit. But there really needs to be analysis of benefits and costs when a drug is being used to treat COVID-19. And again, it's steroids, it's antithrombotics, and it's oxygen. Oxygen is probably the most essential and the most life-saving right now of all the drugs, and all countries need to be prepared now with the oxygen supplies that they're going to need if and when cases go up. Thank you.
And Dr. Mike Ryan, please.
Thank you, Sumia. And just to re-emphasize Sumia's point, this isn't just in relation to drugs like remdesivir. This also relates to drugs like ivermectin and others, and the WHO has issued guidance on that, and manufacturers themselves have issued strong guidance saying, please use our drug for the proper reasons and using the proper evidence. And also, I think this is one of these situations where you need to use the right drug at the right time in the right patient. And that's why primary health care, and having trained doctors and nurses in the front line of a health service that can do a proper clinical examination of a patient and decide which drug, which care that patient needs. That's what's missing in our health systems. Yes, we're missing commodities, but our systems are also missing capability, the capacity to triage patients, the capacity to treat patients, the capacity to diagnose those patients, and beyond the diagnosis of COVID is to assess the severity of that disease in that patient and ensure they get the proper care. An example of this would be something like dexamethasone, which is a powerful steroid, which is what we call a powerful anti-inflammatory. That drug is life-saving when given at the right time in the right patient, because it doesn't stop the virus, it stops the dramatic inflammation that results in oxygen not transferring into the blood. And when that stops and you have inflammation and a person can't get oxygen from their lungs to their blood, the combination of oxygen given by a mask or ventilator with dexamethasone can be absolutely life-saving. But that virus or dexamethasone or steroids don't stop the virus. Giving steroids very early in the course of disease to otherwise well people has its own side effects and can be detrimental. So again, I would just appeal that we need to have a health-centered approach to this. And just using pharmacies to get cocktails of drugs in the hope that these drugs may help you. I understand the instinct, and everyone wants to help their own family, and everybody wants to access the best possible health care. But these drugs are tools, and like all tools, they can have great benefit, but they can also hurt you if they're not used properly.
And Dr. Van Kerkhove, please.
Yeah, sorry. So I'm gonna come in as well because it's such an important question. Both Sumia and Mike mentioned oxygen. So oxygen is something that is life-saving. Medical oxygen is life-saving. And WHO and partners have been working around the world to scale up oxygen availability in countries. This is a work in progress because this is a medicine, this is a treatment that does not have a substitute. We recently launched a website, I think it was launched even today, around some technical consultations around the medical use of oxygen. These are for medical providers to be able to give this life-saving medicine to people who are sick with COVID, but not just COVID, with pneumonia, with other life-threatening diseases. But the most important thing that every single one of us can do in terms of keeping ourselves safe is prevention. So if you could prevent yourself from being exposed to this virus, you prevent yourself from getting infected in the first place. That's the best medicine of all. And so anything that you can do to keep yourself safe, do it, because it's so much easier to keep yourself alive through all of this if you are not infected with this virus. Once we get to the point, if someone is infected, entering that clinical care pathway, that early initial assessment to have your oxygen checked with one of those oxygen saturation to see what type of clinical care you need, this is really critical. And then we have medicines like dexamethasone for people who are severe and critical. But it's really about, as much as we can, about prevention. So do what you can. Keep yourself safe. Keep your loved ones safe. Know what your risk is every day, throughout your day, and take steps to lower the risk of being exposed to this virus in the first place.
Thank you all very much. Next question goes to Sophie Mokoena from SABC. Sophie, please unmute yourself.
Thank you. I just want to ask a question around the current developments in countries such as South Africa. For a year, we've dealt with first wave, second wave. Now people are fearing a third wave, and because of what we saw during the second wave, when there was this new variant, there's fears now that we are likely to have another variant when we experience the third wave, particularly at the peak of the third wave. And already South Africans are panicking. The numbers are rising. Have you detected something in sub-Sahara in terms of the rising numbers and this fear of a new variant that's likely to be detected if we go to a third wave? As people who are experienced in these issues, what's your view? Are we likely to see a new variant?
Thank you very much, Sophie. Handing over to Dr. Van Kerkhove.
Thanks, Sophie, for your question. Your question, the way that you posed it, was about a fear of a third peak or a third wave in South Africa. One of the things I'm most impressed with in South Africa is the ability to get through that first peak, that first wave, or that second peak or that second wave. You know what to do. The country knows what to do in terms of detection. The sequencing capacity across South Africa has increased dramatically over the course of this pandemic. The scientists across the country who are sequencing, using intelligent sequencing of samples around the country, supporting other countries on the continent for sequencing where they don't have capacities themselves, sharing of that information. In fact, many of the scientists have been working directly with us, with our virus evolution working group, sharing their findings about what is circulating, what these virus variants, which mutations are being detected and what it means, carrying out the research to look at transmission, severity, neutralization, all of that. So the capacities in country for detection are strong. The work around the use of public health and social measures. Again, you in South Africa detected the B1351, and that is a variant of concern, showing us that the application of public health and social measures could drive transmission down. So what I would hope is that fear is really turned into something productive. Just be at the ready. You know, you have the systems in place to be vigilant, to be at the ready, to know what to look out for, to know what the warning signs are in case there is a slight upsurge. We are, all of us, you know, living in a globally connected world. Variants are circulating. More variants will certainly be detected, but we know what to do. So we need to be ready to detect, be ready to quickly act, put in those measures in place so that any slight increase, any of these cases or clusters do not turn into community transmission. Having an engaged population to know what to do is part of this army, so to speak, to fight against this virus. So I think, you know, you in the country, people around the country, researchers around South Africa have taught us, have taught the world what to do, and we need to constantly learn from each other. So what we are seeing in other countries can be adopted in South Africa and vice versa. So I would like to see that fear be turned into something productive, turned into something of strength, because I think you know what, the country knows what it needs to do to be able to detect and respond to any virus.
Thank you. And Dr. Mike Ryan, please.
Yeah, and just to follow up and commend South Africa, public health authorities and researchers and others, South Africa showed the way at the end of last year, beginning of this year, when we were confronted with a large wave with the detection of a new variant, and there was a lot of concern at that time. South Africa controlled that wave of disease, which included significant transmission with that variant, by applying the same measures it had for the first wave, and it didn't have the access to vaccine to do that. So it clearly demonstrates that good surveillance, knowing where your problem is at sub-national level, understanding and intensity of community, matching your public health and social measures to the local need, keeping your eye on the big picture at national and global level, investing in surveillance and linking that to genomic surveillance. And again, South Africa is one of the leading lights in the world in being able to link real-time genomic surveillance to public health action. And congratulations for that. And it's putting all of those things together that's allowed South Africa to keep this under control. But South Africa also faces its own problems with health access, and we have many, many people living in conditions in which this virus could spread very easily, so constant vigilance is needed. But I do think we should take a moment to recognize when countries get it right and when they apply all of the resources that are at their disposal, even though those resources are not perfect, and use public health tools to the best possible benefit of population.
Dr. Swaminathan.
I just wanted to add that, you know, we had Professor Abhijit Banerjee today, the Economics Nobel Laureate, speak at the research forum, and he talked about the economic impact of this pandemic and the impact on poverty and on the lives of people who were already living on the edge, you know, who've been further impacted, and particularly when countries have had to put in stringent measures and shut down normal life, people who earn a daily wage living are the ones who get affected, you know, migrants and others who have to go to work every day. So he suggested several actions that governments could and should take to protect those, to make sure that people are not starving, that children are not going to get undernourished, you know, and he called it good economics, but it's also the right thing to do. And so I would invite people to listen to this talk, which is going to be up on our on a YouTube channel. It's being broadcast live now, but it's going to be there. And we've had some excellent talks also by, you know, Michelle Bachelet, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Professor Peter Singer, well-renowned philosopher and ethicist, really talking not just the pure science of it, but also how it's impacted people and what we need to do to address their other needs. Thanks.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on that because I think it's worth speaking and saying more. The Research and Development Blueprint for Epidemics and all the partners in it, in WHO, Sumia's team and mine, we co-lead on the project, but the real driver are those thousands and thousands that we were just remarking before the meeting, Sumia, just how this group had grown from hundreds to thousands and thousands of scientists around the world working together across so many different areas and coming together unselfishly to share knowledge. Knowledge is power when it comes to this virus. So we'd just, again, like to thank all of our partners who are, they're not listening to this press conference, thank God, they're all upstairs talking about really important stuff like understanding how better to control this virus and for the next year and laying out the roadmap. And I'd like to thank Sumia for her leadership in this. And I do think this demonstrates that you have to, if you can link science to action, we do it here through the work that Sumia leads in science and Mary Angela on technology and pre-qualification and myself and so many others. Our organization is only the best when it brings together the power of science, the power of public health practice, the power of health systems, and the power of our capacity to respond quickly. So it's a really impressive thing to see, and point you all to go look at that conference when it's rebroadcast.
Thank you very much, all. Looking at the time, I think we can squeeze in one more last question as we started late, and that would be Latika Bourke from Sydney Morning Herald. Latika, please unmute yourself.
Thank you. Always lucky last. In April, the WHO released a statement following the seventh meeting of the IHR Emergency Committee. One of those temporary recommendations you made to state parties was to, quote, reduce the financial burden on international travellers for the measures applied to them for the protection of public health, e.g. testing, isolation, quarantine and vaccination. And so I wanted to ask you, in the context of hotel quarantine, where countries require this to enter the country, should the governments or the citizen be paying for that? Because Dr. Mike Ryan, I know we've talked before about vaccine passports leading to huge inequity. It strikes me that this is actually something that's going to become a public health measure, but actually trap people in terms of their own financial circumstances if they can't travel for urgent pressing needs and, say, even separate medical health care in the home countries.
Thank you very much. Latika, Dr. Ryan.
Yeah, thanks, Latika. It's a complex question because there are obviously very severe resource implications specifically around issues like quarantine for travellers arriving in the country. Dr. Nedret Moroglu is with us as well. Nedret may be able to comment on this as well. I think the recommendation in general from the IHR is that, and this is a general principle in the IHR, is that the traveller in the case of restrictions should not suffer economically from measures that are used to improve and protect the health of population as a whole, because that then is unfairly burdening an individual with the costs of a public health action. So when you go into quarantine because you're a case in a country, you should get the support of the government and not have to pay for that if you're put in a quarantine hotel. Let's say you're a case in a country and there is a quarantine hotel or somewhere where you go, you're a contact and there's a quarantine hotel. If you're a citizen and you're a contact and you go to a hotel and then someone charges you for the stay, then that you'd imagine the state would pay for that. It's not so clear when visitors are coming from the country outside because they're non-citizens. But the purpose of the measure is to protect the citizens of the country in which the other person is entering. That's the stated purpose. So in that sense, what has to be worked out is who should bear the burden of that protection. The state doing the protection of its own citizens or the traveller coming into the country. And countries have policies for entry, and if people breach those policies of entry, then the state could turn and say, well, you've entered on false pretense, therefore you must cover the cost of your quarantine. But if someone has entered on with full disclosure, and someone has entered with full disclosure within the policies of the country, then what I think the committee were saying to governments that they really do need to consider that they should be covering the cost of that. But that is very difficult. Not all countries can do that. So therefore, it's a recommendation for the committee that all states should seriously consider the arrangements they put in place, how those arrangements were put in place, and the fairness of those arrangements vis-a-vis the traveller, because one of the principles underpinning the IHR is that we have the maximum amount of effort to reduce the international spread of disease with the minimum impact on those who are travelling and trading, and therefore we have to balance those two within that, with the primary interest being in the public health. Nedret, if you'd like to add.
Microphone, please.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mike. You covered most of it, but maybe 2 points. They repeated this recommendation during their last meeting due to two reasons. Actually, one is the standardized approaches. They would like to have harmonized, standardized approach, not only to costing and who pays for it, but also to the whole overall travel restrictions as well, or requirements in terms of vaccination, testing and quarantine. And the other area they would like to really emphasize is that this should not further push the inequities. So that has to be one of the areas that needs to be protected by some of the mechanisms.
Thank you very much. And that was Dr. Nedret Emiroglu, co-chair of the WHO Secretariat, to the Commission. Thank you. With this, we reach the end of today's press conference, and again, sorry for starting late. Thank you all for your participation. We will be sending the audio files and Dr. Tedros' remarks right after the press conference, and the full transcript is again available as of tomorrow. If you have any follow-up questions, please send an email to mediainquiries@who.int, and apologies to all those who we didn't get to today. Many thanks, and handing over to Dr. Tedros for the final remarks.
Thank you, Christian, and thank you to all colleagues from the media for joining us today, and see you in our upcoming presser, and bon weekend.
Welcome back, and listening to Pan Africa Journal. And
the Pan-African Journal is a worldwide radio broadcast, and we just heard the World Health Organization briefing from yesterday, Friday, May 14th, 2021, featuring leading health experts discussing the COVID-19 pandemic, the vaccination rollouts, among other public health issues. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment for the Pan-African Journal for this week. Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast for Saturday, May 15th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. That was the voice of Candy Staten and saying, "Darling, you're all that I had, and you all what we have here at the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast." And right now we want to go into our concluding segment. Deals with a lot of the major international news stories, particularly the unfolding struggle in Palestine, as well as other issues. Let's listen in.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
China confirms probe landing on Mars with the Zhurong rover to begin exploration. At least 10 Palestinians killed in violent clashes on Friday. And UN chief calls for withdrawal of foreign fighters from Libya. Hello and welcome to Africa Live here on CGTN. I'm Mahia Mutua in Nairobi. Also coming up, in business, IMF set to complete its final review of Egypt's $5.2 billion standby loan program. And in sports, Boulder's Al Ahly host South African giants Mamelodi Sundowns in the first leg of their CAF Champions League quarter-final. Welcome to Africa Live. Now, after around 3 months of orbiting Mars, China's Tianwen-1 probe has successfully touched down on the Red Planet. It landed safely on Saturday morning, marking another milestone in China's space program. CGTN's Wu Lei has more from the Beijing Aerospace Control Center.
Tianwen-1's probe, lander and rover first separated from the orbiter on their way to the surface of the Red Planet. Chinese scientists say the entry, descent and landing only took about 9 minutes, but they said it was the most challenging part of the mission.
It takes about 17 to 18 minutes for the signal to get from Earth to Mars, so engineers on the ground couldn't intervene during this process. The lander rover combination had to rely on the preset systems.
After descending, the lander rover combination finally touched down in the designated landing area, the southern part of Utopia Planitia, a large plane on Mars.
This is the first time that China has actually ventured out of the Earth-Moon system and reached extraterrestrial planetary space, and we achieved the goal of orbiting and landing just with one single mission. Later, the rover will conduct scientific expeditions.
China's mission to Mars was officially set up in 2016. During the whole operation, the China National Space Administration has worked closely with the European Space Agency and other organizations from countries like Argentina, France, and Austria. Chinese engineers and scientists are taking photos to remember this historical moment. The years of effort have finally paid off. They say the experience gained this time round will pave the way for the country's future missions into space.
We're planning the Mars sample return mission in around 2030, because we have other missions, asteroid exploration and Jupiter exploration, and we're going to conduct those missions in an orderly manner.
The lander is expected to deploy in a wrap for the rover Zhurong before rolling out onto Mars and exploring. Zhurong is designed to work there for at least 90 Martian days. Wu Lei, CGTN, Beijing.
Well, Chinese President Xi Jinping has sent a congratulatory message for Tianwen-1's successful landing on Mars. He says the landing marks an important step in China's space exploration. He says it's a leap of the country's space program from the Earth-Moon system to the interplanetary system. The mission makes China one of the world's advanced countries in the field of planetary exploration. Xi's message was read by Vice Premier Liu He. Vice Premier Han Zheng watched the landing at the Beijing Space Flight Control Center. Well, the landing on Mars marks a huge and historic achievement for China. Let's take a look back at how the country got there.
China's most powerful heavy lift carrier rocket, the Long March 5, carrying China's Mars probe and now being rolled on a mobile platform to the launch pad.
迎来了第一个中国的卫星，这是一个很大的步伐，这是我们国家有了第一个行星际的探测器绕到火星转了。
Moving on, the death toll continues to rise as violence between Israelis and Palestinians enters its sixth day. Israel renewed airstrikes on Gaza early Saturday. Hamas responded by firing rockets into Israel. Palestinian officials say at least 10 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces during violent clashes along the West Bank. At least 132 people have also been killed in Gaza, including 32 children and 21 women. Hundreds have been wounded. 8 Israelis have died in rocket attacks fired from Gaza. May the 15th marks the anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel, but for Palestinians, that's the day when they were forcefully evicted from their homes. Earlier, we talked with Noor Harazin in Gaza and Yael Lavi in Israel for the latest from both sides.
We can hear the Israeli airstrikes every now and then. We can also witness rockets being fired from Gaza towards Israel. Yesterday during the night, the Israeli warplanes raided a home in Ashat refugee camp. And this camp, this refugee camp, is a very densely populated area. There is no streets there. There is only alleys between the homes. 7 people were killed, including 5 children aged between 13 and 5 years old. The only survivor from this attack, from this airstrike, Israeli airstrike, is a few months old baby. This brings up the number of Palestinians killed in the Gaza Strip on the past 6 days up to 125 Palestinians. And more than 37 of them are children. Right now we can hear the sounds of new explosions in the Gaza Strip, so apparently this escalation is still going on.
While the United Nations has expressed concern over the conflict between Israel and Palestine and has called for an immediate ceasefire in the region, a UN spokesperson addressed the issue in a press conference.
The Secretary General appeals to all parties to immediately cease the fighting in Gaza and Israel. The ongoing military escalation has caused great suffering and destruction. It has claimed scores of civilian lives, including, tragically, many children. The fighting has the potential to unleash an uncontainable security and humanitarian crisis and to further foster extremism, not only in the occupied Palestinian territory in Israel, but in the region as a whole. The parties must allow for mediation efforts to intensify with a view to ending the fighting immediately.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says there are still foreign fighters and mercenaries in Libya. This is despite a ceasefire agreement signed in October, which called for their withdrawal. In December, the UN estimated there were at least 20,000 foreign fighters in Libya. Guterres made the statement in a report to the UN Security Council. This comes as the country's interim government prepares for the December 24th election. Guterres urged stakeholders to continue making progress in order to ensure the polls take place. Well, for more on this, we're now joined by David Otto Endley, Director on Security for Horn of Africa Institute for Peace and Security. David, do you think the SG's latest appeal will be heeded?
Thank you, Mahia. When it comes especially to the decade-long crisis in Libya, very deeply divided, which has been there since 2012, the United Nations is not seen as a neutral party. Of course, that is because it backs the Tripoli government of national accord. And, you know, again, that, you know, calls into question its own neutrality against the Libya National Army, which of course is run by veteran Khalifa Haftar. You know, so I think it will be very difficult. Again, this call was made, as you rightly said, in October 2020. They were given 90 days to withdraw various, militias and various machineries. At the time, the UN did estimate that there were about 20,000, but some other figures put machineries in Libya to close to 40 to 50,000. Now, the issue is that, because both sides, and when I say both sides, I mean the Government of National Accord and the Libyan National Army, do not trust each other. It's a matter of security before disarmament for this side. So I think, it's going to be a very difficult scenario, taking into consideration that even the Government of National Accord has militias, mercenaries, and foreign fighters from different governments. We've seen the role that Turkey plays in supporting the Government of National Accord. We've seen Egypt, United Arab Emirates, France, and some say Russia is supporting the Libya National Army. So I think without a proper trust in each other, this call is not going to be heeded.
And David, why do you think there's still persistent presence of foreign fighters and mercenaries still in Libya?
I think the simple answer is that both sides do not trust each other to disarm and let go of the support that they get from these militias. Now, the UN, of course, has talked about the formation of the Government of National Unity, the GNU. But this is not the first time that elections in Libya have been planned. So it is a matter of trust. And because the UN, doesn't have...
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast for today, Saturday, May 15th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. I would like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of our program, and of course, here in the United States, today is May 15th, 2021, and there were demonstrations across the U.S. in solidarity with the people of Palestine. And, of course, at the Pan-African Newswire, we, of course, have been following the situation in Palestine, and, of course, this is something that you can find more information about by just logging on to the Pan-African Newswire at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And you can stay abreast of not only the situation in Palestine, but some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. And if you'd like to have access to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com / Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com / Pan-African Journal. And in our concluding segment, we would like to listen to the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, speaking at the United Nations General Assembly. Let's hear excerpts from that speech of September of 2018.
L'Assemblée va entendre.
The General Assembly will now hear the statement of His Excellency, Mr. Mahmoud Abbas, President of the State of Palestine. I ask protocol to accompany His Excellency to the podium.
Assalamu
au nom de l'Assemblée générale.
On behalf of the General Assembly, I have the honor to welcome to the UN organization His Excellency Mahmoud Abbas, President of the State of Palestine. I invite him to address the General Assembly.
Al-Quds lays.
Jerusalem is not for sale.
وحقوق الشعب الفلسطيني.
And the Palestinian people's rights are not up for bargaining. In the name of God, the most merciful and beneficent. Excellency Ms. Maria Fernanda Espinosa, President of the United Nations General Assembly. Your Excellency, Mr. Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, distinguished ladies and gentlemen, peace be upon you. Peace be upon you. We will stay and we will maintain our faith in peace. We will maintain peace. And we will achieve our independent state with peace because God is with us and our cause is just and our people have sacrificed a lot and because you, lovers of peace and God, is always against those who are plighting us with injustice. And God is enough. In these days last year, I came before you appealing for freedom, independence, and justice for my oppressed people who are suffering under the yoke of the Israeli occupation for more than 51 years. And today, I return as this colonial occupation continues to suffocate us undermining our serious, unwavering efforts to build the institutions of our cherished state, which this august General Assembly recognized in 2011. This year, ladies and gentlemen, the Palestinian National Council, the Parliament of the State of Palestine, convened and renewed the legitimacy of our national institutions through the election of a new leadership for the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. This parliament undertook important decisions whereby I have to review the agreements, political, economic, and security alike that have been reached with the Israeli government. And to review the future of the Palestinian National Authority, which unfortunately has been rendered without authority. The Parliament also instructed me to suspend the Palestinian recognition of the State of Israel until Israel recognizes in its turn the State of Palestine on the 4th of June 1967 borders. I was also instructed to approach international courts, including the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to investigate Israel's breaches of treaties and the aggressions by the Israeli occupying forces and settlers against our people on our land and our holy sites. And you might note, ladies and gentlemen, that the Israeli settlers and even the Israeli army on every single they are committing acts of blasphemy against our holy sites, especially Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ladies and gentlemen, last July, Israel adopted a racist law that crossed all the red lines, and it was called the Nation-State Law of the Jewish People. This law denies the connection of the Palestinian people to their historic homeland and dismisses their right to self-determination and their history and heritage, as well as the United Nations resolutions relevant to the Palestine question and the agreements concluded with Israel. This law will inevitably lead to the creation of one racist state, an apartheid state, and thus nullifies the two-state solution. Israel practices discrimination, but actually this law comes as the epicenter of this discrimination. This law discriminates against the Palestinian Arab citizens in Israel, granting the right to self-determination exclusively to Jews in Israel, thus legalizing discrimination against those Arab citizens who constitute 20% of the population of Israel, in addition to other non-Jews who have immigrated to Israel. Thus, they are stripped of their rights of citizenship. At least 5% of the current population of Israel are immigrants. They are non-Jews. They are Christians and Muslims who immigrated from the former USSR. They have also been stripped from the rights to citizenship. This law constitutes a gross breach and real danger, both politically and legally, and reminds us of the apartheid state that existed in South Africa. Thus, we reject this law and condemn it in the strongest terms. We further call on the international community and this August Assembly to act to reject it and condemn it as a racist, illegal law and null and void. The United Nations has also had condemned the apartheid South African state in several resolutions in the past, bearing in mind that thousands of Jews and Israeli citizens have rejected and protested against this law. 56 Knesset members out of 120 voted against it because they believe that it's a racist law. That's why I call upon the United Nations to follow the same line, to follow in the footsteps of a number of Israeli citizens who rejected this law altogether, in letter and in spirit. This racist law, ladies and gentlemen, talks about what is called the land of Israel. Can you ask the Israeli government what exactly constitutes the land of Israel, what the borders of the state of Israel are? I challenge anyone to tell us what they are. Where are the borders of the state of Israel? Please bring me a map and just show me where are the borders of Israel. This racist law constitutes another stigma on Israel, and anyone who consents to it and condones such acts. This law is just like other Israeli laws that legislated theft, piracy, and confiscation of the land, property, and funds of the Palestinian people. Ladies and gentlemen, We have always fully and positively engaged with the various initiatives of the international community that have aimed at achieving peaceful solution between us and the Israelis, including the Arab Peace Initiative, which was recognized by the Security Council in its resolution 1515 of 2003. We continued on this path with the administration of President Trump from the start of his tenure with the same positive engagement, and we welcomed his launching of the Initiative of Peace, and I have met with him numerous times. We awaited his peace initiative with utmost patience, but we were shocked by his decisions and actions that completely contradict the role and commitment of his administration towards the peace process. So in November 2017, his administration issued a decision to close the PLO office in Washington, D.C. He then announced his recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and thus transferred his country's embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And he even boasts that he has removed the issues of Jerusalem, refugees, settlements, and security off the negotiation table. All such decisions threaten the Palestinian national cause and constitute an assault on international law and relevant UN resolutions. The U.S. administration went even further in its assault by cutting assistance to the Palestinian National Authority, the UNRWA, and Palestinian hospitals in occupied East Jerusalem.
Welcome back. That was the address delivered by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas at the United Nations General Assembly during September of 2018, discussing the national oppression of the Palestinian people. And this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and you've been listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast for Saturday, May 15th, 2021. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in for another edition of our program. If you'd like to have access to this program, just log on to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to its website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.